in other words, a reduction of America's ability to maintain its own defenses without negotiation, they're not going to give anything. So I would summarize by saying that a vote against the draft, in my opinion, would be a vote that seriously jeopardizes peace initiatives in the United States and around the world. And without question, it is a vote that will make the United States the second strongest nation in the world, with all the implications that has insofar as the ability of the United States to keep the peace and to negotiate for peace in this great period.
Mr. President, on the subject of the United Nations debate over China, some critics of your new policy on the UN, and I refer specifically to Dr. Walter Judge, who made a statement yesterday, are saying that the expulsion of the nationalist government would not be legal under this charter without a vote of the Security Council making such a recommendation to the General Assembly. Now, I recognize that we hope they will not be expelled. Can you address yourself to the legalities of the 2020 administration's position is on that?
Mr. Bailey, we spent many months looking into the legality of this situation, and in fairness to Dr. Judd, I should say that there are different legal opinions that you can get with regard to what action is needed for purposes of expulsion, and whether Security Council action is required as well as the other. We, however, have reached the conclusion that position we presently take, which has been stated by the Secretary of State and by Ambassador Bush, is the legally sustainable one. To put also our policy in clear perspective, we favor the admission, we'll vote for the admission of the People's Republic to the United Nations, and that will mean, of course, obtaining a Security Council seat. We will vote against the expulsion of the Republic of China, and we will work as effectively as we can to accomplish that goal. Beyond that, I would have no further comment at this point.
May I follow just one other point on that? When you say the favor the obtaining of a Security Council seat by the People's Republic, that implies that the Republic of China would be removed from the Security Council.
Our analysis indicates that this is really a moot question. In the event that the People's Republic is admitted to the United Nations, the seat in the Security Council would go to the Republic of China, and to the People's Republic, and that, of course, would mean the removal of the Republic of China from the Security Council seat. And the statement that was made yesterday simply reflected the realities of the situation in the United Nations.
Mr. President, now that you have a new economic policy, I'm wondering if you would care to make a prediction as to what kind of a year this will be, what kind of a year next year will be.
Well, I stick to my previous prediction that 1971 will be a good year from the standpoint of the economy, and that 1972 will be a very good year. As a result of the new policy, I believe that the last quarter of 1971 will be better than I had originally thought it might be. Rather than being good, it will be considerably better than good. And I think 1972 will be a very strong year. I base these predictions, however, on the assumption that we will get the cooperation of Congress on the tax front. It is essential for continued economic expansion that the Congress support the tax initiatives that we place before the Congress. And I hope that when the Ways and Means Committee finally votes out a bill, that it will pass the House and then go to the Senate, and we'll get here for signature within a short of possible time as needed for
Mr. President, in that same area, we do accept a 7% investment tax credit rather than a 10% and 5%, and also would you accept an increase of $200 or $250 in minimum standard deduction?
The problem of what the President accepts, of course, is somewhat controlled by what he can get. Now, in this instance, under Press Secretary Connolly's testimony very carefully before the Ways and Means Committee, and you know he faced these realities in answering questions. We believe that the 10%, 5% approach is much the better one because it will give the charge to the economy in the year that we need, which is now. On the other hand, 7% would be better than none. When we look also at the Secretary's situation with regard to raising the standard deduction and the minimum exemption, there are a number of proposals we know in this area that have been suggested in both the House and the Senate. We believe that our package is a balanced one. It is the right one, and we're going to fight for it. On the other hand, if the Congress, after due deliberation, moves in another direction, which is essentially aimed at our goal, then I will have to consider the measure when it comes here, and I would tend to consider it affirmatively unless it completely blew the top off my budget. The main problem on the second thing you mentioned is the degree that we go in terms of providing additional relief for individuals. If that degree is too high, without a corresponding cut in spending, the budget implications are enormous, and that would mean an additional fire under the border as far as inflation is concerned.
Mr. President, would you agree to the decision on the possibility of a nuclear attack in Alaska?
Mr. Kilpatrick, we are considering all of the factors involved, including the environmental factors, and I will be making a decision, I would say, within the near future. That is a matter which has been discussed in this office on several occasions. I am waiting for all of the evidence to come in, and then I will make a decision.
Mr. President, we will
announce it, of course, and
Mr. President, might the changed political picture in South Vietnam, specifically from that race to the presidency there, have any effect on your future plans as far as the level of United States troops and United States activity in that region?
As far as our plans for ending the American involvement in Vietnam are concerned, we have to keep in mind our major goal, which is to bring the American involvement to an end in a way that will leave South Vietnam in a position to defend itself from a communist takeover. Now, as far as President Pugh's political situation is concerned, I think it's well to put that subject in perspective. We would have preferred to have had a contested election in Vietnam. We, however, cannot get people to run when they do not want to run. It should be pointed out, however, that in fairness to the democratic process and how it is working in South Vietnam, the congressional elections, the elections for the National Assembly, should not be overlooked. 80% of the people of South Vietnam voted, as compared to that of 60% who voted in our congressional elections in 1970. And a third of those who were elected opposed President Pugh, and some of those who were elected to the National Assembly were those discharged that they could not be elected before the election because the election would be rigged. Now President Pugh has made the election in October for the presidency of the vote of confidence. There are criticisms to the effect that this vote of confidence will not be an active one, but he has invited foreign observers in to see it and to observe it. My view is that the United States should continue to keep its eye on the unless President Hu does have a contested election. Now, let's just look at what that means in terms of worldwide policy. We presently provide military and or economic aid to 91 countries in the world. I checked these various countries as far as their heads of government are concerned. And only 30 of those countries do they have leaders who are there as a result of a contested election by any standards that we would consider fair. In fact, we would have to cut off aid to two-thirds of the nations in the world, in Africa, in Latin America, in Asia, to whom we are presently giving aid if we apply those standards that some suggest we apply to South Vietnam. I again say that we would prefer, as far as South Vietnam is concerned, that its democratic process would go faster. We believe that considerable headway has been made. We believe that the situation from that standpoint is infinitely better in South Vietnam, where they at least have some elections, than in North Vietnam, where they have none. And we're going to continue to work for that goal.
What happened at Attica, has that made you reconsider plans amendments that you offered to Attorney General Mitchell to call a conference to speed up the proposal? And what do you think the Attica incident will do to the penal reform movement?
Well, like all tragic events, it has its affirmative aspects. And in this case, it's, I think, very helpful to know that Governor Rockefeller has already moved in that direction, prison reform. Prison reform with regard to the problems of prisoners and their proper treatment, and prison reform, which will deal with the problem of guards in prison and their protection. As far as I'm concerned, I still believe that the problem of prisons in the United States, which incidentally is primarily not a federal problem so much as it is a state local problem, the problem of prisons in the United States is one that very much needs attention. I have been particularly impressed in that respect, incidentally, by articles that have been written by Al Hoffman, the Gulf Returner. And as a result of having read his articles, I talked to the Attorney General, and we are working on this project. Perhaps this will give it additional impetus. The other, with regard to Governor Rockefeller's action, I know some of you ladies and gentlemen was impressed or surprised that I, with all the problems I have, stepping to support him on a problem that was not mine. That's just happens to be the way I react. You may recall that when Prime Minister Trudeau had a somewhat similar situation, I called him and said that I backed what he had to do under very difficult circumstances. I can imagine that this is the most painful, excruciating experience of Governor Rockefeller, a very good man and a very progressive man, has had in his term of public service. I knew that he would never have gone as far as he called that morning when I was in the cabin, unless he had felt that it was the only thing that he could possibly do to try to save some of the guards that were held hostage. Now, when a man in a hard place makes a hard decision and steps up to it, I back him up, and I don't try to second guess him the next day when some of the other returns come in. I still back him. I believe that people with public positions, whether they are governors or, for that matter, prime ministers or maybe even presidents, cannot get in to demands for ransom, as was the case with the demand made in this instance.
Mr. President, we're told that you have not made decisions on the basis of conversations that have so far. Have you been able to accumulate any impressions or any insight that you would share with us that sort of indicate what might happen after?
Well, Mr. Capwell, I do not want to give advance notice at this point as to what thinking we may be doing in this field. Well, thinking is all right, but the direction of that thinking, for the reason that we still have consultations to take place. I'm meeting right after this conference with the representatives of governors, state legislatures, cities and counties. We'll meet tomorrow with congressional leaders, and there are other meetings that are scheduled before September 30th when I've asked that all the evidence be brought in. I can, however, give you an indication generally of how we're going to come out. First, let me say that the statement that was made by Mr. Terry Spang represented, as Mr. Ziegler pointed out this morning, or at least in time this morning, represented what is a strongly held view, primarily in the business community. It does not represent what that we have foreclosed the matter as far as our own thinking is concerned. On the other side of the spectrum, on the labor side of the spectrum, there is a desire for voluntary restraints only, a tripartite board, so to speak, and in between you have various suggestions. These are my Kennedy conclusions with regard to the direction. First, there will be a strong, effective follow-on program. The American people over these two will be strong. It will be effective. Now, it will deal with the problem of wages and prices and will restrain wages and prices in major industries. Second, it will require the cooperation of labor and management. A third, and this is vitally important to me, it will have teeth. You cannot have job owning that is effective without teeth. Now, this is the direction that I have given to those working in the programs, and we are pulling together again. I will make the announcement in mid-October, 30 days before, at least 30 days or more before this freeze expires. very closely with the Ways and Means Committee, and Secretary Connolly returns, he will begin consultations also with the Senate Finance Committee, with Senator Long and Senator Bennett and their counterparts. We do not want to have an extended discussion in the Senate of our tax proposals, as we have a draft.
Mr. President, the international aspects of our economic program seem to have shaken up our friends more than our enemies, in Europe, particularly in Japan. What is your feeling about that? Is this going to be a worry for us? Aren't we hurting some very good and important friends in the pocket?
Well, it's inevitable that those policies would shake up our friends rather than our potential enemies, I should say. Rather than our opponents. Because it is our friends with whom we primarily have trade and monetary dealings. And of course, our international policies dealt with trade and monetary policy. On the other hand, what we have to realize is that the structure of international monetary affairs that had been built 25 years ago and then patched up from time to time over the years has simply become obsolete. It was essential that the United States move, as it did, to protect its interests and also to get a solution to that problem. Now, one question that I know is often asked by our friends, by the Japanese, for example, in Asia, and by the Europeans in Europe, how long is temporary? That's a temporary surcharge. My answer to that is that if all we were seeking was a temporary solution, temporary would be very brief. But we are not seeking a temporary solution. A temporary solution is one that I would say would be going back to the old system and patching it up again. What we are seeking is a permanent solution, and that is why the length of the temporary surcharge will be somewhat longer, because we need to address ourselves not only to the matter of monetary policy, exchange rates. We have to address ourselves to burden sharing. We have to address ourselves also to trade restraints, including non-tariff barriers. This is a time for our friends around the world, we are all competitors, to build a new system with which we can live so that we don't have another crisis in a year. With regard to the Japanese, I think I could best summarize our dilemma in this way. After the Japanese were here, I found that both from the information they gave and the information we had ourselves, that Japan is our biggest customer in the world, and we're their biggest customer in the world. Also, I found that Japan, at the present time, produces more than all of the rest of East Asia combined, including the People's Republic of China. Now that shows you the problem. It means that the United States and Japan inevitably are going to be competitors because we are both strong economies. On the other hand, it means that friendship and alliance between the United States and Japan is indispensable. So what we are trying to do, and this was why these discussions were helpful, what we are trying to do is to work out a new system that will recognize the realities so that we can reduce these tensions that have developed, the number of crises that have come up over and over again in the international monetary field in the future. The other point that I would make with regard to the United States, I know that some have raised the question as to whether in my message to the Congress I was really announcing to the world that we were, by looking to our own interests, we're going to now be isolationists. On the contrary, a weak America will inevitably be isolationists. An America that is unable to maintain its military strength, and incidentally, in the whole free world, the United States pays two-thirds of the military bill today. A weak America that is unable to have its economic policies abroad, our economic, our foreign aid policies for this, inevitably will withdraw into itself. We have to have a strong America, strong economically, and strong in the sense of its competitive spirit, if the United States is to continue to play a vigorous, active role in the world. That's why I address myself to that problem, and that's why we move, as drastically as we had to do at home and abroad to deal with the basic problems that hurt America today economically.
Mr. President, Senator Muskie has some comments about the political climate for a black vice president. What is your thinking on that subject?
Well, if you gentlemen know, I have stated, and I will state again, that I will not do presidential press conferences discussed in 1971 to discuss 72 politics. And I will follow that rule today and in the future with regard to similar questions that come up. With regard to the general proposition of prejudice in the United States as it affects politics, I will be glad to reiterate my own position that I've stated quite often in 1960, and some of you who had to follow me remember, and again in 1916. I believe that it is, frankly, a libel on the American people to suggest that the American people, who do have prejudices, just like all people, and we must agree with that, but that the American people would vote against a man because of his religion or his race or his color. Now, having stated that general proposition, there are occasions when that happens, I'm sure, but the American people are very fair-minded people, and they tend to bend over backwards when they're confronted with this problem. Before the 60 elections, it was said that America could not elect a Catholic as president, based on the Al Smith case in 1928. 1960 dispelled that, as I well know, and the country knows. I think the example of Ed Brooke in Massachusetts is eloquent demonstration of the fact that the American people, when confronted with a superior man, will not vote against him because of his race. Only 2% of the people of Massachusetts are the same race as Ed Brooke. Yet he won overwhelmingly for Attorney General, and he won overwhelmingly for the United States Senate, and he's going to win a landslide victory again this year. Now, what would happen on the national scene is a matter of judgment. And I am not going to get into that from a political standpoint. But I do say, however, that I think it's very important for those of us in positions of leadership not to tell a large number of young people in America, whoever they are, that because of the accident of their birth, they don't have a chance to go to the top.
Thank you, Mr. President.
I think with the Canadians, you've got this enormous inequality.
Adding local thing, but
that sounds good.
start this out of the federal role.
No question about it, Mr. President. That was the disaster to overthrow a government in the middle of the Civil War. But the stability of government is the main problem. That was the problem.
You got a good answer to the thoughtful answer that won't ever get picked up anymore, but it's kind of interesting. You might want to use it on TV on that thing. They won't ask you the question, unfortunately, but they said, you know, well, after this election, completed, will the U.S. objective in Vietnam be met? And the way he said it was just great. I couldn't see him, but I don't care. He said, no.
Not for several generations.
Not for several generations.
No, I know.
No, you know, the thoughtful no.
No, I, on Vietnam, what
was the idea that democracy doesn't spring up full grown until 500 years?
What good is it?
But at least we'll be on the road.
That you weren't sort of, that you weren't defensive, that you weren't trying.
Not in the point. It caused an anomaly.
Thank you.
must just get so bored meeting with these governors. I think that's the problem. You know, they have nothing to talk about.
But he's the one that's pushing. He wants to, you know, take on the world.
He's, I can see now.